Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Council votes to pump an additional $11 million into the Eastland Yard Sports Complex. We hear from council members. Parents react to CMS proposals on student assignments as the legislature expands the Opportunity Scholarship Voucher Program, but not without Democratic opposition. The legislature also gets pushback to its newly enacted mandate that sheriffs cooperate with ICE on identifying immigrants who may be here illegally. With polls shifting in her favor and some seeing a possible win in North Carolina, Vice President Harris comes to Charlotte again for a rally. And we remember the life and contributions of State Representative Kelly Alexander. Here to talk about those stories and more is Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of their Flashpoint program on Sunday mornings. Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. And Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com and host of their Equal Time podcast. Good morning to you all. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Morning.
So, on the recommendation of their Economic Development Committee, Charlotte City Council voted unanimously this week to spend $11.3 million on the Eastland Yard Sports Complex. Traditionally, council does not look favorably on projects asking for more because of cost overruns, but this time it didn't faze them, despite allocating $30 million to this same project just last year. Why? What's the difference here?
Well, they had a lot of time to prep for this and kind of get their heads around it because they were warned that there would be more money requested back in December by city staff who said, hey, we're going to need more than 30. Sorry. So they've had 9 months to wrap their heads around it. And I think the other thing is Eastland has been so long coming. You know, the mall was torn down more than a decade ago. It's been closed. It's been kind of this open scab on the east side. And there's already redevelopment going on part of it, part of the site. So getting this sports complex going is really a something that I think city council just, they kind of want to be done with.
As several Eastland area residents spoke with WCNC-TV about this long time coming development on the old Eastland Mall site.
It'll be him. We might be dead and gone by the time it get him, but it'll be him.
I think it's going to continue to be delayed. Honestly, because they've been working on this for how long?
It's been a long time, and then they just turn around and do what they want to do.
Ben, were those comments gathered before or after the vote?
That was before. I think it expressed the skepticism that much of Charlotte has that something's actually going to get done. To Eli's point, I think at this point, it's worth the $11 million just to get it off of their back burner. I mean, at some point, if you're a city leader, you can only deal with transit and the red and silver line at Eastland Yards for so long before you're finally like, all right, we need some new stuff, folks. We need some new material to, like, you know, tackle in our meeting. So I think, and listen, in today's economy, I think there's understanding that there's going to be overrides and overruns when it comes to costs. And if it's $11 million for a site that's sat empty for the better part of the last 14 years, get it done, move on.
And when this was being discussed last week by the Economic Development Committee, Councilwoman Marjorie Molina reacted in a way that seemed to resonate, to point out your words, Ben, to resonate with the entire council.
For me, that's a hell yes. And it's a resounding hell yes.
And when it came to a vote for the full council, Councilwoman Dimple Ashmera expressed her support this way.
This is a monumental step in the right direction. This feels like a dream that is finally being realized.
So it's a long time coming project, and this piece of the puzzle that is Eastland Yards has hit some stumbling blocks along the way with the Tepper Sports, etc., and Councilman Ed Driggs wanted people on the east side to recognize that council is paying attention to them.
The city's willing to step up and increase its investment in order to allow this plan to move ahead, and I hope the people of East Charlotte appreciate that.
For newcomers who haven't had to endure this story for the last 10 years, just to bring you up to date, the city bought the land, the old Eastland Mall land, in 2012. They tore the mall down a year later. And for 11 years, they've been working on developing this piece of land. And this particular part of the plan was supposed to be the home to Charlotte FC's practice field and headquarters until David Tepper changed his mind. So now they brought together two private concerns who bid on this project. They made them work together on this, and they've come up with this amateur sports complex. What will this ultimately offer?
Ultimately, I think the biggest thing is, aside from the sports, but also, I mean, some estimates say $169 million of economic impact. I think 500 jobs is what some are saying. So I think that's the real tangible about this. I mean, at some point, this was part of Tepper Sports. At one point, it's going to be a Target. I think to have a tangible impact like that, when you start talking about money and jobs, it's long overdue for the folks of East Charlotte.
I was going to say, ultimately, with along with the sports fields and the indoor sports complex, restaurants and stuff, the bigger picture is creating a center of gravity. Eastland was that center of gravity for East Charlotte for, a few decades, and drew people there, drew economic activity there. And since it's been struggling and then closed and then empty, there hasn't been that economic center, that sort of identity center. So they're really hoping that this gives people a reason to go there again and gives East Charlotte this identity and center again.
This is what I'm trying to figure out. This is going to be a mixed-use complex. There's going to be living spaces. There's allegedly going to be retail. There's going to be restaurants. And now we have this sports complex, and it's billed as an amateur sports complex. What does that mean? Does it mean that there will be teams being able to use free of charge or a small rental the facilities, that individuals will be able to go there and play racquetball? What does it mean?
Yeah, I think it's similar to like a Charlotte Sports Center, if you've ever been to one of those. Sort of what you just said, folks can come in and sign up for intramural teams if they want to host there, things like that, but also just open fields for folks to rent out, play on, things like that.
And I think that Councilman Driggs's comments reflects the fact that a lot of folks in those neighborhoods, in that neighborhood, feel that while Charlotte was paying attention to other neighborhoods and investing in them, that they have been neglected. So that's a big piece of it as well. And the economic impact, as Ben mentioned, that there will be jobs coming there, and money coming to that neighborhood. And so I think that is a big piece of it as well.
So once Tepper Sports dropped out of this, it took a long time for the developers to make proposals, and the city cobbled together these two entities to say, work together, come up with something, and they did. And they came to council last year and got $30 million. Now they're coming back for 11.3. Why did they need more money? What happened?
Well, as they got deeper into the planning, they looked at what needed to be built, and they said, boy, these things that are not really the sexy things like retaining walls and site grading and drainage, this is going to cost more. You've seen that with a lot of projects lately, but $30 million was kind of a rough estimate. And as they got into it, they said, not enough.
So the mayor was on the program on Wednesday, and we talked about this, and I asked her if this public funding of a private project is unusual and why it's worth so much public investment in a project that will be privately owned and operated, and if they would pay that investment back in some way to the community over time.
Well, I don't think it's unusual to have an economic development effort. When we recruit a lot of new businesses and want to have people come in, new investments, this is not something that is unique. It is actually the way that government helps people move on, because it's not just that they're getting money, because they're going to have taxes that they're paying back to us as a result of this. Right now, as we sit and look at Eastland, the site, we're getting nothing in terms of this except, there's no taxes, there's no ability. We think that, I believe all of the council believes that we can have something that will at some point pay it back in terms of safety, in terms of taxes.
So this new infusion of money, $11.3 million, means that work should begin sometime early next year, 2025. What's the estimated completion date on this project? Anybody know?
I believe we said 2026, fall of 2026 okay. is, I believe, what we said, yeah.
And one of the components of this plan was to have been this Ice Capades Chalet. That will no longer be part of the initial development, and that will evidently shrink the size of the indoor facility that they're going to build. Was that because of the cost cutting they needed to do to make this work?
Yes, and also I think just evaluating the mix of things that would be there and what there's a lot of demand for. I mean, if you have any involvement with youth sports and amateur sports, you know there's a ton of demand for fields. It's depending on where you're trying to schedule. It's often hard to do that. I will say this means there won't be a replacement for the Eastland ice rink, which sadly was lost before I got here.
Yeah, that was one of the major components of Eastland Mall. They had this center court ice rink that people used all the time. It was kind of ahead of its time.
I think that was almost a part of the project that was born in nostalgia. And then once they started to look at the reality of what the demand was, they said, all right, let's not just include this just for the fun of letting people remember the old rink.
So as long as we're playing back City Council's greatest hits this morning, number two on the Billboard charts today has to be the vote last week to spend $91 million to buy Norfolk Southern's O-Line tracks for the Red Line commuter train to Davidson. This before we go to the legislature to ask for permission for a referendum on next year's ballot for a 1 cent sales tax to fund it, which means we might end up with tracks, but no money to put a train on them. We spoke with Ed Driggs about that last week. He called it a risk worth taking. And in our conversation this week with Mayor Lyles, she expressed those same sentiments.
We have the opportunity to showcase what we're doing with a plan that's new and updated to the technology and the purposes that we have right now for infrastructure, then I think we'll be okay. But if it's not, we understand that we took a really good swing at the bat and hopefully we'd get a home run.
Swing for the fences. The plan she referred to there was Charlotte Transit's plan, which came under criticism from legislative leaders. The plan was then reshaped to be characterized as a roads first plan, but that plan still really hasn't been written down and it hasn't been approved. But council did vote to support a proposed bill that has been drafted for the legislature that would not only authorize a sales tax referendum to be floated next year on the ballot, but would put together an organization to oversee the transit plan and transit itself. What would that look like, Eli?
So that would be a 27-member board appointed by various entities, including the city, the county, the towns, the governor, and the leaders of the legislature. So a much bigger board, and they would serve for a staggered 4-year term. So instead of being a city department, CATS would be overseen by this 27-member board.
And several of those members would be appointed by people in Raleigh. Well, I think one by the governor, one by the state senate, one by the state house. And when I asked Mayor Lyles about the state playing such a strong role in a local issue, she did not see this as a negative, and she explained why.
We're looking longer term at having a regional system. And so a regional system is what requires opportunities for everyone. So I think that when we're talking about this, it's not just about Charlotte. It is about thinking long term, 20 years out. We want to make sure that people that are going to be in our community, in the growth that we're having, that we're including everyone. And I think that that's appropriate.
So there's actually some good news here that came out in the Charlotte Ledger this week, at least for some of the towns surrounding Charlotte with regard to this reworked transit plan. And when we come back, we'll get into some of the details of that. We'll also talk about CMS and recent reaction to their assignment plan and the school vouchers being expanded and some shenanigans going on in Raleigh with regard to that. We're coming right back. It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the Local News Roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. Listener funded. Eli Portillo is with us. He is our senior editor here at WFAE News. Ben Thompson is anchor at WCNC TV and host of their Flashpoint program. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for RollCall.com, host of their Equal Time podcast. And Ryan Pitkin is co-founder and editor of Queen City Nerve. This week, as long as we're talking about this transit plan, Tony Macia in the Charlotte Ledger reported that folks in Mint Hill are on board with this plan, which would not bring transit to their town, but would bring higher sales taxes. And the reason is that $6 million each year would might be flowing into their coffers to be spent on roads because of this new roads first approach. And one of the Cornelius town managers has called this a, well, the Cornelius town manager has called this a game changer for his town. Is this aspect of this transit plan getting enough coverage, Eli?
I don't think or Ben? So. I don't Both? Think so yet because originally it was supposed to be around 80% of the money flowing to transit. Now it's 40% to trains and 20% to buses and 40% dedicated to roads. So the legislature has kind of gotten what they wanted in a roads first plan. And big chunks of money are going to be going to these cities, you know, and towns. In Charlotte, it could be $102 million a year for roads. Cornelius, almost $6 million, which they could use for expanding US 21. Huntersville could get $12 million a year. Matthews could get $5 million a year, but they say that's not enough to compensate for the loss of the Silver Line East train. So even though all the focus has been on transit, this plan actually contains a really large and significant chunk of funding for the roads here, especially in the smaller municipalities around Charlotte.
Ben?
Yeah, I think, though, the bigger picture, especially when it comes to passing some sort of plan, having Mint Hill support is really kind of crucial because at this point, all the surrounding towns now support the transit plan outside of Matthews. And Matthews and Mint Hill being neighboring, to have the support of Mint Hill, although for different motivations, for different reasons, is kind of big for the supporters who are wanting to see this thing go through.
And what is interesting about this is, although it says these towns will get money for roads, and I mentioned that Mint Hill is anticipating they might receive as much as $6 million a year for roads, it can be used for a variety of transportation projects. So it's not just going to be used for roads. What kind of projects are we talking about?
Well, this could be some sidewalks and, you know, road infrastructure improvements. You could see it used for, I don't know, bike lanes, stuff like that. I do think the majority of it will be used for asphalt roads themselves, though, in the end. Like Huntersville has said they anticipate using their $12 million a year for road resurfacing and things like that.
Yeah, they're even allowed to use it, I think, for electric car charging stations and emergent technologies that are not even in our radar quite yet. Some people have called this a windfall for these towns because this is money they're spending anyway, but they can now spend the money they've been spending on roads for other things because this new money is coming in. Does that help this plan's chances of approval in Raleigh?
I think so. And Matthews has said that they are upset about it because they think the state should be spending more money on these roads instead of the local sales taxes. I think, you know, going with what Ben said, it helps it in that it's gotten these towns on board, and it's really important for Mecklenburg's delegation to be able to go to Raleigh and say, look, everyone's on board, except Matthews, but pretty much everyone's on board. And the road funding helps them to secure that and keep it.
Yeah. It's like any sort of appropriations funding or pork barrel spending is what they call it in D.C. You get different buy-in for different people for different reasons, but you don't even really care as long as you get the buy-in because that's what it's going to take. So whether you motivate different towns with roads or bus driver transit is what it would be for Matthews, which I don't think they're sold on yet. You look for ways to get that buy-in.
Ryan, you want to chime in here before we move on?
I'm actually just getting a text from NC House Rep John Autry right now saying that he's against it and he thinks that 50% requiring 50% completion before starting any other rail project and capping rail to 40% of the revenue is a non-starter for him. So just wanted to drop that breaking news on me because he's texting me while he's listening.
And he's in Raleigh. He's one of our representatives in Raleigh. Of course, John Autry, correct me if I'm wrong, is a Democrat. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Let's moving on here to the schools, which are underway. Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board has been considering some student assignment changes for about a month now. These proposed changes largely affect magnet schools. But at a recent public hearing on this topic, they got some feedback. What did they hear, Eli?
Well, a lot of folks are upset about boundaries being shifted. They are worried about their specific schools. You know, it's worth noting that this particular reshuffle only affects about 1% of all students in CMS. But, you know, for the people who are affected by that, it's a really big deal. For example, Davidson K through 8 school will become an elementary school, excuse me, with middle school students reassigned to nearby Bailey Middle. So, you know, that's a big deal if your kids are in Davidson, you know, in sixth grade and they're now going to go to a different school for the last 2 years of middle school. And I think it's a preview of what we can expect going forward with a more comprehensive review.
So several students signed up to speak at that meeting this week against adding 9th and 10th grade students to high schools located on four central Piedmont Community College campuses. Kai Methledge attends a CMS middle college program, and he shared this observation.
If you change the middle college program to early colleges only, having students enter in the 9th grade, you'll be forcing students who are barely even teenagers to choose a career path. These students are not mature enough.
I believe Kai is a student. Out of the mouths of babes, that seems to make sense to me. Why is the superintendent recommending this?
Well, it's a tighter integration of their their early college program with actual college classes. I think they would have access to more advanced classes. I think Kai, the student, is right that you never know what's going to happen. At the same time, I'll just say in 9th or 10th grade, I decided I was going to be a local journalist. And, you know, here I am later and I just can't seem to get away. So sometimes you do know.
Look where these immature decisions lead you.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, several parents urged the board against moving Dorothy J. Vaughan Academy of Technology in Northeast Charlotte to Parkside Elementary. Parkside is newer. It has more room. But Renarda Hamilton sees a downside.
What I know is the fact that the little brown boys and girls who are sitting there, who are looking at themselves to be in science, to be in technology, they're losing their one opportunity to do that.
Mary, does she have a point?
You say Mary? Well, yeah. I mean, we see the achievement gap in Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools with students of color. And so, as Eli said, even though not that many folks would be affected by it, the kids and the parents who would be feel quite passionate about it. And she's letting the leaders of CMS know.
Meanwhile, the General Assembly has been putting money toward expanding opportunity scholarships, money that parents of all income levels could use to defray the cost of a private education. The program is so popular that it ran out of money, leaving affluent parents who already have children in many cases in private schools and can certainly afford to put them there without these vouchers. But that changed this week. The General Assembly voted more money to fully fund the program. How much more?
$248 million. I'm sorry.
Totally, just under about $500 million in all going into next year.
Mm-hmm. $463 million, I think. Yes.
A lot of money. So that could have gone and would have gone. Maybe it wouldn't have gone, but it could have gone to the public schools. Democrats and others see this as a program that will, in fact, hurt public schools, which are already in need of more funding. Democratic Representative Marvin Lucas from Cumberland County told WUNC it will do just that. And that's not all.
We're going to diminish our public schools for the sake of those who can afford to do what they're doing already, going to private schools.
Of course, the Republicans control the legislature. They passed the bill. They will send it to the governor. The governor is likely to veto it. But the GOP has a supermajority. So one would imagine this is a done deal, Ryan?
I would say so, yeah. I mean, with the supermajority, there's not much that can be done at this point. And there's also been a lot of discussion around the, you know, they fit in the whole ICE bill that, that forces local sheriffs to participate with ICE into this as well. So it's, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah, and I heard this morning, and I don't know if it's true, and one of you can comment on it if you know more about this, that they know that the governor's going to veto this. They know they can override the veto because they have a one-vote majority, but they're going to hold off on vetoing this bill until after this election because they know it's unpopular even among Republicans. Does anybody know if there's any truth to that?
Well, I can't independently confirm that reporting. I can tell you that, you know, the original opportunity scholarships, while controversial, were less controversial. Now that you're talking about completely removing the income sort of requirements and allowing completely wealthy families to then send their kids to private school, that is a far more controversial proposal when you have North Carolina ranking about 40th in the country for teacher pay. It becomes a different game.
Mary.
We've dropped in teacher pay, as Ben says, and this is in a competitive environment to have teachers. And we see every year that there's a shortage of teachers, particularly in certain areas. And also, as you say, it's unpopular. These kinds of proposals in other states, even conservative states like Texas, where there are a lot of rural schools, there have been a lot of opposition from Republicans. And just recently, South Carolina's Supreme Court has struck down their law. It was a tight vote because according to their constitution, you can't have taxpayer money going to places that would elevate one religion or another. And we see here, even in North Carolina, that much of this money goes to religious schools. And it's kind of always been interesting to me because I thought, you know, LGBTQ, for instance, parents and kids, they're paying taxes in North Carolina that would benefit schools that their children would not be allowed in.
I'm going to bring you into this conversation, Eli, in a second, but she's correct. Mary is correct that the South Carolina State Supreme Court voted down their recent law to allow these what they call education scholarship. I don't know what they call it. I'm sorry, but they have a law on the books, the Education Scholarship Trust Fund Act. And they voted 3-2 that it was unconstitutional because the Constitution in South Carolina says no money shall be paid from public funds for the direct benefit of any religious or other private educational institution. I truncated that a bit. Eli?
Yeah, I was going to say that while there's been obviously a lot of focus on the immediate effect here, you know, this year there were 55,000 children on the wait list trying to get opportunity scholarships. This funding will clear that. One thing that's going to be bigger in the coming years is the amount that is allocated towards those scholarships, which increases each year. It'll be up to $825 million by 2032, I believe. So, and that's annually. So, you know, you're closing in on $1 billion annually in the coming years going to these opportunity scholarships. And that is a big concern for education advocates here who say, look, you're going to be starving the public schools more and more as the amount of funding for these opportunity scholarships increases each year.
Which is probably part of the plan. The bill does not include raises for teachers. That's a provision that was in the House version of this bill, and it includes something else that was already alluded to, and that is something that Republicans have long wanted and that Democratic sheriffs in the state have resisted. They have been refusing to cooperate with ICE by identifying people in their jails as being here illegally, and now they will be required to cooperate. This is a split, of course, along party lines. Mecklenburg County Democrat Laura Budd believes the bill sends a bad message to the immigrant community and will end up hurting business here.
If we really want to be number one and stay number one for business in the United States of America, this is the exact opposite approach to doing that that will be successful. It does not do anything but roll up the welcome mat and tell people you're not welcome. We don't want you.
But Republican Rules Chair Destin Hall says those concerns are overblown.
We're only talking about folks who are not only just here illegally, but that they've also been charged with a serious crime in our state. So murder, rape, other violent crimes. not driving without a license.
Of course, this is part of the Republican playbook at the moment, claiming that those who are here illegally are violent, insane criminals who rape and pillage at every opportunity, none of which is true. What are the statistics involving crime committed by people who are here in this state without documentation?
Well, I don't have the exact numbers, but I do know that overall, native-born Americans, it is shown in surveys, commit crimes at a higher rate, which makes sense. If you're here and you're trying to stay under the radar, you don't go out committing crimes in general. Of course, you can always elevate that sensational crime. And I know that sheriffs, many of them who oppose it, also say it makes folks who are victims of crimes, who are undocumented, a little reluctant to report it, because they don't want to be involved in the system in any way. And it makes those communities targets of people who will then say, ah, I'm going to, you know, victimize the folks who won't have any recourse about reporting it. So it's a complicated issue, more complicated than folks would have you believe.
Well, one of the arguments against this is that this will make those communities less safe for the very reason you just cited, and therefore it will make the surrounding communities less safe because unreported criminal activity will go on and begin to spread. Is there any way to tell if that is true?
You know,
well, I mean, I think you often hear Republicans talk about this in political through a political lens, which is understandable. But I think once you talk to like local law enforcement, to Mary's point, I mean, we've been covering this issue for years, going back to the 287G program at the Sheriff's Department here in Mecklenburg County. But you talk to local law enforcement, I emphasize local. And they talk about how they work day in and day out, 365, to build trust within these communities. So there's trust, cooperation when it comes to some of these investigations, criminal issues. If, from a practical standpoint, if they have to enforce some of this, they will tell you that it makes their job much more difficult.
Because people will not come forward. And that's a problem in any community, it seems to me. Very quickly, I have 30... I have 30 seconds. Back in Raleigh, the House overrode Governor Cooper's veto of a bill that, among other things, would cut the appointment power of the governor. What does this mean, Eli, going forward?
So the NC Building Code Council was 17 members appointed by the governor. They amend the building codes and those wonky but very important things. Now, starting in January, the council will be down to 13 members, three appointed by the House Speaker, three by the President of the Senate, and then the rest by the governor. So this cuts down the governor's power to directly make appointments to the Building Code Council.
Does that mean they think Lieutenant Governor Robinson's going to lose this election?
Well, it's been a trend for years to cut down the governor's power here.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to talk about Vice President Harris being in town for a rally yesterday, and Michelle Morrow finally talks to the press, to Ben. We'll talk about that. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business, to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Tux on the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE in Hickory. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Eli Portillo, senior editor for WFAE News. Ryan Pitkin is a co-founder and editor of Queen City News. Mary C. Curtis is a columnist for Roll Call, host of their Equal Time podcast. And Ben Thompson is an anchor at WCNC-TV and host of Flashpoint on Sunday mornings on that station. Just days after what is likely the only debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris, which even Fox News said she won, Harris was back in North Carolina. She came to Charlotte and to Greensboro yesterday, and that's because North Carolina appears to be in play, and Democrats would like to snag it. She held a rally yesterday afternoon at Bojangles Coliseum. She took the opportunity to hit on a key issue, abortion.
And we know how we got to this issue, because Donald Trump handpicked three members of the United States Supreme Court with the intention that they would undo the protections of Roe versus Wade, and they did as he intended. And now, in over 20 states in our nation, they have what I call Trump abortion bans, including North Carolina and every single state in the South except Virginia. Think about that. Every single state in the South except Virginia. Now, one in three women in America lives under a Trump abortion ban.
So, Mary, you were at that rally yesterday. What else did she talk about?
Well, she was talked about the importance, you know, North Carolina being an important state. And she, of course, has been here and returned again and again. She was reveling in a very good mood because of the debate. I think that's understandable. And she hit some of those high points. In fact, when she talked about her plans for health care and a young woman who she had a troubled pregnancy of twins who needed health care. She introduced Vice President Harris because she said her bill, because of having caps on insurance, would have been $1 million. But because of the healthcare policies of the Obama and Biden and Harris, that wasn't the case. So it was interesting, though, when she talked about Donald Trump's plans for health care, the whole crowd yelled, "Concepts of a plan." It was like a call and response. Because, look, you know, she talked about some, you know, U.S. relationships and so many things with foreign countries at that debate. And Donald Trump just dug into, you know, the lie that he won the 2020 election and talked about that harmful stereotype of people eating pets. And I felt that it wasn't just enthusiasm. But people there felt an urgency, as in, we have got to win this thing. And you saw Josh Stein, Jeff Jackson, Mayor Lyles pretty much bopping across the stage, and Roy Cooper, the governor, who got probably the biggest applause after Kamala Harris. And I talked with one 93-year-old Holocaust survivor, a beautiful woman, though she still bore the scars of surgery to repair damage to her face from the fragments of a German bomb. And she basically said she was very inspired by Harris. She had to be there. And she said, people don't realize, listen to Trump's rhetoric about elevating one religion, jailing opponents, all of those things. It could happen here, basically, she said. And mm-hmm. I was struck by that.
And you mentioned all these other Democrats. Democrats are very hopeful in this year's election in North Carolina. At least the down ballot races are hopeful that they can come up on the long end of the stick. And she mentioned some of those races.
And it's not only the presidency that's on the ballot. There are many important races, including Josh Stein running for governor. Whose opponent was handpicked by Donald Trump and wants a ban, a total ban on abortion in this state. Right. So these are the stakes in this election.
You know, that's a lot of noise coming from the no one that attends her rallies. At the debate the other night, Donald Trump said that nobody attended her rallies and that she bussed them in and she had to pay them to be there. I don't think that's the case. How many people were there at that rally at Bojangles Coliseum?
It filled it. I think it was about, 9,000 or so? I don't know the exact number. And I think there was 17,000 at Greensboro. And it was like a really... I've been covering these elections since 2008. And for Democrats, it was quite a rowdy crowd. They were yelling, you know, dictator and all these things. It was the energy level that people try to compare it to Obama. And it's even something different, I would say.
And WFA, he spoke to some of the attendees at that, just a few of the attendees at that rally, and they didn't seem to fit the description that Donald Trump had of her attendees at the debate the other night.
I have to go. It's history, herstory, basically. So why would I miss out? I took PTO, day off work, see amazing Kamala. So we're going to win in North Carolina.
One of my close friends, she sent me the link for it. And she was like, you want to join me to go to the rally? And I was like, what? Is she going to be here like in person? And they was like, yeah. So I signed up for it. And I was like, yeah, I got to be here. And then I sent it to my mom and my sister and then my other best friend and then my little niece who is 4. She loves Kamala, so we had to make sure she got here too.
So Harris was in Charlotte and Greensboro yesterday. I believe her vice presidential running mate has been here or is about to come, not necessarily to Charlotte, but back to North Carolina very soon. This is all part of a swing state tour the Harris campaign has embarked on. This was her 9th trip to the state. Following the presidential debate, polling analyst Nate Silver said our state would be a tipping point for Harris. We have 32 electoral votes. Both campaigns view us as one of seven critical battleground states. Harris and Trump have been neck and neck, but according to Silver, two high-quality polls now show Harris leading by a slim margin, which makes North Carolina the second most likely tipping point state. The Quinnipiac University poll has Harris leading by 49% to 46%. The WRAL News poll has her leading by the same margin. Both polls were conducted prior to the debate, but Silver gives Trump the edge. He gives him the better chance of winning both North Carolina and the Electoral College. I think 65 million people now are all told watch that debate. Is it too early to gauge the impact of it on voters here?
I think the thing with Trump is he has supporters that will go with him no matter what. He gets around 46% of the vote. It's basically his ceiling and floor. So I think you could see the enthusiasm. I talked to several state legislators who were there and city councilman Malcolm Graham and others. And it's got, the name of the game is turnout, particularly in Mecklenburg, which has had a problem with Democratic turnout. So I think we'll have to see. But I don't think it's going to move the needle as much as should be expected after she totally dominated him in that debate.
Eli.
Yeah, so North Carolina has 16 electoral votes, and,
sorry.
It's okay. I was just like, wait a second, are we bigger than Texas now? But, I think
only in our minds.
Exactly. I think that all the investment you're seeing from the campaigns here shows that North Carolina is very much in play, of course. There's an optimistic case, which I think you could look at 2008 and say that's the last time that they really had, these kind of big rallies like you just saw Harris put on with Obama back then. And they won the state for the last time by a small margin, but they carried it. You could also make a pessimistic comparison case and say, well, in 2012, they brought the DNC here to Charlotte, had a lot of visitors, a lot of enthusiasm, and lost the state, and they've done so by narrow margins since then. So, I think it's too soon to say what the effect will be, but it looks more and more like Democrats are going all in on trying to flip this state.
Thank you for correcting me. As I typed it yesterday, I thought, that's not right. But it teaches you don't believe your fingers. Your fingers don't have brains. Ben, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to also say that Mr. Trump typically overperforms on election day. And so Democrats looking with glee about this, I would caution that I think in most cases, most pollsters would tell you that Kamala Harris needs to outperform him by a number of points, not just one or two, but by a number to clear what has traditionally he done on election day.
There are three statewide races getting a lot of attention. Obviously, the governor's race, where Attorney General Josh Stein appears to be ahead of Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson. Then there's the Attorney General's race, in which Democratic Congressman Jeff Jackson has reportedly seized support among younger voters and urban voters to build a lead over Republican Dan Bishop, 43% to 36%. That was conducted by talking to likely voters, and this increases Jackson's lead over a previous WRAL-TV poll, Eli. What organization conducted this poll? How much stock can we put in it?
Well, I think this was conducted by WRAL, and I don't have the name of the polling firm in front of me, but I think beyond the numbers themselves, which show, yes, Jackson with the lead, but also a large number of undecided voters. It's important to look at the momentum, and the momentum appears to be shifting more towards Jackson. So the last WRAL poll, I believe they were close to tied. Now you've got consistently more support for Jackson, also among groups like men, where I believe they're tied. It's more than 600 voters, so it's a pretty big sample here. But beyond the momentum, also, as I mentioned, keep in mind the number of undecided voters, with 1 in 5 voters still basically shrugging and saying they don't know. It could go either way.
The other race getting national attention is the one for state superintendent of public instruction. The incumbent Republican was defeated in the primary by Michelle Morrow, who homeschools her children, has made a highly controversial statements over the course of time, and her Democratic challenger, Mo Green, who used to run the public schools in Greensboro. Ben, although we booked Michelle Morrow to be on this program for an hour the night before she was scheduled to be here, she canceled, and now she won't return our calls. But she did talk to you for Flashpoint. Lucky you. Tell us about the conversation.
Well, this is awkward for you, I guess. No, no. Listen, this race, I'm confident in saying, has never gotten national attention. It often doesn't get local attention, but this is actually getting national attention. A lot of it, fair or not, is based on Michelle Morrow's past tweets. She's a really engaged political activist here in North Carolina, and you know, we talked it, and she was passionate. Engaging, even affable. And I actually asked her about some of the tweets. If you're not familiar, back in 2020, she tweeted about in a variety of different tweets, but sort of suggested that Democrats like Barack Obama and Joe Biden should be assassinated. Now, she now says, and she said to me, that it's sarcasm that she was using in those tweets. So,
yeah, this you asked her the question fairly directly.
Why shouldn't parents be worried about that? You are asking them to trust you with their kids and talking recklessly like that.
Well, let me share with you what people are really concerned about, the serious voters of North Carolina. They are concerned about the fact that our current school system was hiding from parents the fact that children wanted to change their gender and be called different pronouns.
That's a notable deflection. She has seemed to moderate her tone in the few media appearances that she's made outside of her social media platforms, many of which have been scrubbed since those earlier comments were made. Did she seem reasonable? Did she answer your questions? Did she have policy positions then, other than the culture wars when it comes to running North Carolina's public schools, Ben?
She did. And, you know, I even said to her, I was like, listen, I went over Mo Green's Twitter account. I went over Catherine Truitt's. I even went over Ellen Weaver's in South Carolina, the superintendent down there. And they all talk about school issues. Mo Green talks about some campaign stuff. I was like, you're talking about the Kennedys and Hamas and all these other things. And she's like, yeah, so I enjoy politics. That doesn't mean I'm going to bring it into the classroom, but I enjoy tweeting about politics. No surprise, I asked her about the news about the week, about vouchers being expanded. She agrees with that. Surprisingly, she also does agree, and she agreed with Mo Green, that teachers should be paid more here in North Carolina.
So, very quickly, because I have very short on time here, the sending out of absentee or mail-in ballots was delayed by a lawsuit by RFK Jr., who was trying to get his name off the ballot. The Supreme Court stopped it. Have they gone out yet? Because they're supposed to be out 60 days before Election Day, and now they have to be reprinted.
No, and there are more than 2,300 combinations of ballots that they have to consider across, you know, every precinct and all the local races and different counties. So it's going to take a while. They've said all 100 counties will send ballots at the same time. So they're going to wait till everyone is ready. And they've said that they might miss the September 21st deadline for sending ballots out to overseas military absentee voters.
Mary, I have 10 seconds.
And they also have to destroy all the other ones. And we know how terrible our mail system sometimes is and unreliable. So this is another reason we know that Republicans are worried about losing North Carolina, because this lawsuit, other lawsuits to stop the voting. Yep.
So finally, Charlotte lost a major figure last Friday, State Representative Kelly Alexander, who spent more than 15 years in the legislature. He passed away. He, like his father, was a leader in the civil rights movement, and Mayor Vi Lyles talked about that on this program on Wednesday.
It was in his DNA, civil rights. Between his uncle Fred and his dad Kelly, that family is iconic for what we believe in equity and inclusion. And it wasn't easy, because you know that there was all kinds of difficulties, bombing of houses that they owned and lived in, but they persevered and they never gave up. And Kelly inherited from his dad, I think, the value system that the NAACP and all of these organizations that were doing civil rights embraced.
Kelly was once the president of the North Carolina NAACP, and he was a leader with a level head. He joined us a couple of years ago during the demonstrations that had broken out around the country in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and he used that occasion as a teaching moment on what to do if you wanted to make change and get things done.
If you believe that some of these changes are necessary, it's time for you to not only just march in the street, but to reach out to those people who can make a difference and change these things. You got to communicate with your legislators. You've got to communicate with your folk in Congress. You've got to communicate with your senators. You got to express what you believe as a citizen should be the new norm. If you fail to do that, we're going to get not anything that's new, but simply a modified version of the status quo.
Kelly Alexander was 75. Fortunately, we don't have time to talk about the Panthers. Panic time, they said in ESPN. Head for the exits, women and children first. Eli Portillo, Ben Thompson, Ryan Pitkin, and Mary C. Curtis, thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.